Chapter 78. It wasn't the media circus they had anticipated it would be. It was much worse. The streets around the police station and town hall were choked with satellite trucks. News organizations from CNN to the BBC to TMZ to PBS had set up temporary outposts in Paradise. Although Jesse had played a big part in unleashing the beast, even he was surprised by its appetite. He'd worked in L.A. and understood that people had a fascination with lost treasures, rumors, and celebrity. But Terry Jester wasn't King Tut, nor was the Hangman's Sonnet master tape the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yet just the possibility that the tape might resurface after 40 years had created a feeding frenzy. What surprised Jesse even more was the media's apathy toward human life. No one at the press conference seemed to care about the fact that Hump Bolton had bled to death in a Southie bar, or where King Kernet's body had been discovered. No one was interested in the fact that Maud Cain's murder and Rudy Walsh's assault were now closed cases. Maud Cain, Kernet, Bolton, and Rudy Walsh had been reduced to sideshow status at the circus. They mattered only as adjuncts, as bit players in the drama of the tape. The press were far more interested in Jesse's mention of the Dragonfly Ring and its pending return to the Kane Museum than they were in the lives and deaths Jesse described to the assembled crowd. No one ever lost a bet underestimating human decency, Nita Thompson had said to Jesse at one point in the proceedings. Believe me, I know. I work with politicians. Mayor Walker was nowhere in sight, of course. That was part of the deal Jesse had made with her. For her backing, allowing him to handle things his way, Jesse had agreed to be out front and to take the flak. But the mayor had sent Nita Thompson along to keep an eye on him and to protect her interests. There were several questions about Evan Updike. Oh, the press was very interested in him, and that was great with Jesse. I don't mind telling you that Mr. Updike seems to have vanished. The last best photo we have of him is from the mid-80s. Here are some images we do have of him. Photos, both black and white and color, appeared on a screen off to Jesse's left. These photos are downloadable off our website. Any help we receive from the public about his whereabouts is appreciated. After Updike's images went up, there was finally some interest in Maud Cain, Kernet, and Bolton. But most of the questions were hypotheticals. Why did Updike choose to do this now? When do you think the tape will finally resurface? Who actually owns the tape? Will Terry Jester come out of seclusion if the tape reappears? When the press conference was finally winding down, cell phones began ringing, trilling and buzzing. Even the reporter asking the question stopped mid-sentence to check her phone. Jesse looked back at Nita Thompson, who shrugged. Jesse, not prone to overreaction, got a sick feeling in his gut, remembering how all the cell phones in the room had gone off simultaneously in the immediate wake of the Boston Marathon bombing. "Okay," he said. "Someone tell me what's going on." Several of the correspondents turned their phones around to face the lectern, but it was impossible for Jesse to make out what they were showing him. It was only when Ed Selko stepped up to the microphones and handed Jesse his phone that he finally understood. He felt a great sense of relief at what he was shown. There were no explosions, no bodies, no sirens, no panic. On Selko's screen was an image of a metal reel. On top of the metal reel was a crinkled piece of masking tape. And on the masking tape, written in very faded black marker, were the words, "The Hangman's Sonnet Master." Jesse turned to Nita Thompson and said, "It won't be long now." Chapter 79. Whoever had the tape, whether it was Updike or not, had finally gotten exactly what he wanted, a worldwide audience. Jesse's comment to Nita Thompson was spot on. That evening, about 6 hours after the press conference ended, Jesse heard from Roger Bascom. "You better get over to the Wickham estate." "Why?" "He called." Jesse didn't need further explanation. Before leaving for Stiles Island, he called Lundquist. "We're going to need your people at the Wickham estate. The guy with the tape called. He'll call again, and when he does, We're going to need equipment the PPD doesn't have. Lundquist said, understood, and hung up. When Jesse got to the house, the electricity in the air was palpable. Stan White, chomping mercilessly on a cigar, was pacing back and forth in front of an end table on which sat a cordless phone in its dock. Bella Lawton, dressed in black slacks, a lightweight green sweater and flats, was pacing a parallel course to White's, but in the opposite direction. She had a cell phone stuck to her right ear and a predatory smile on her face. As she walked through a plume of White's cigar smoke, she waved it away with her left hand. Only Bascom, seated on the sofa, seemed disconcerted. Bella pulled the phone away from her ear and pumped her fist. Both Mick and Keith are in. White stopped in his tracks, nodded his approval, and said, good. How about McCartney? His people still haven't gotten back to me, but almost everyone else on the list who couldn't be bothered is now calling and apologizing. But what are they saying? White asked. Yes. White smiled and started pacing again. Bascom, looking relieved, noticed Jesse was there. Thanks for coming, Bascom said. That finally got Bella and White's attention. Jesse didn't waste any time with niceties. When did he call? Bascom looked at his watch, but White answered, 27 minutes ago. Was it Updike? Who knows, White said, turning his palms up. His voice was distorted, like in horror movies. What did he say? What did he say? White repeated Jesse's question, his voice heavy with sarcasm. What do you think he said? He said he had the tape and that he wanted enough money to choke a stud farm full of horses to give it up. Anything else? White blanched a little. Yeah, that he would burn the tape if we didn't meet his demands or if we tried to pull a fast one. Did he say when he'd call again? No, Bella said. Only that he would call again soon. Jesse kept at it. Did he say anything about not involving the cops? Both White and Bella laughed at that. Jesse was confused. Did I say something funny? Just ironic, Bella said. He specifically asked for you. He said he'd heard about your reputation, and that when the money and tape were to be exchanged, he wanted you to do it. Jesse didn't like it. He hadn't liked much about this whole affair from day one. The request to involve him seemed particularly odd. Maybe not. He knew better than most that crime and criminals didn't follow a script, that it wasn't like on TV. Logic didn't always come into it. People did stupid things. Cops depended on people doing stupid, impulsive things. Still, he didn't like it, but he didn't have time to dwell on it. The call came into this phone? Jesse asked, pointing to the end table. Bascom said, it did. Remember, the Wickhams rent this place out every summer, so getting this number isn't like hacking the NSA. I guess not. Jesse turned back to White. Did he prove to you he has the tape? What do you mean? I mean, did he prove to you he actually has the tape, as opposed to having a photograph of it? Yeah. He listed all the songs on the tape in order. He even played a little of the first track for me. The guy had the balls to say he thought the piano was a little out of tune on the second cut. Can you believe the onions on this guy? Believe me, Chief Stone, he has it. Jesse rubbed his palm over his cheek. Do you have the money he's asking for? White laughed again, puffs of earthy cigar smoke blowing in Jesse's direction. Trump wouldn't have the money this guy wants. So no, I don't have it. But don't worry, give old Stan 24 hours and I'll get it. How? Chief, you worry about catching the bad guys. Leave this to me. People have wanted to hear this album for 40 years. 40 years ago, most of them were teenage dreamers. Now, some of them are rich. Very, very rich. And what? You don't think there's some music label or rock star out there who wants to get some publicity? But Jesse had already stopped listening to White, his mind busy piecing together the myriad things that were bugging him about the case. Chapter 80. The call came 2 days later. Although Jesse hadn't wanted word to get out that the tape was being offered for ransom, word had somehow gotten out. There was little mystery in that. Jesse had no doubt that Bella Lawton and or Stan White had purposely let it slip. He who has the most to gain often has the loosest lips.
This is the hangman. $6 million in used, unmarked, untraceable bills,
the distorted voice said over the speakers Lundquist's people had set up in an adjoining room.
One penny less, and the tape burns. Any chemicals or other traces on the bills, the tape burns. When you raise the money, put a personal ad in the Globe that says, I desperately want you back. TJ, I'll be in touch.
That was all he said. Through the use of cell towers, Lundquist's people traced the call to a rural area in western Massachusetts. It's probably a burner phone that's already been ditched or destroyed, Lundquist said. In rural areas, we can be off by as far as 20 miles. He probably called from a car, and if he's mobile, we're not going to catch him this way. When Jesse talked to White, he was surprised to see Jester's manager looking so glum.
What is it, Stan? Can you raise the $6 million?
It's not that. I have a big offer from one of the legacy record labels. They're willing to cover the ransom up to $6 million, then pay Terry a generous advance and percentage.
Then what's the problem?
You want to know what's the problem? The problem is me. The label wants independent verification of authenticity.
Lundquist was confused. Why is that a problem?
It's a problem because the only people who can authenticate the tape are Stan, Updike, and Jester himself, Jesse said. Jester and White are self-interested parties. Updike is the prime suspect.
Lundquist nodded. I see your point. Let me get together with my people and see if we can't get a better handle on the caller. Once Lundquist had left the room, White said, The tape's gonna burn. None of the other offers are even close, and it would take too long to piece together...
Wait a second, Jesse said, interrupting White. I have an idea.
What idea?
Not what, who?
Roscoe Niles. He told me...
It was White's turn to interrupt.
You know that fat drunk bastard?
I do. He loves you too, Stan.
Screw him!
You better rethink your attitude, Jesse said.
Yeah, why's that?
Because I think he can authenticate the tape. He told me you played the tape for him just after it was recorded.
White clapped his hands together.
That's right. Oh, my God, that's right. This was when he was still a big shot in New York radio, and his word was gold. People used to line up to kiss his ring and get him to play their songs on the radio. Airplay on his show meant everything. I've heard rumors he was offered thousands to play songs. He was offered girls, cars, houses, trips around the world, but he never took a penny. The fucking guy wouldn't even let you buy him a drink. If he liked a song, he'd play it. If he didn't, it was dead. Sometimes you could get another jock on the station to give you a little airtime, but not Roscoe Niles.
Did he dislike the Hangman's Sonnet? Is that why you two hate each other?
Nah, Chief, Roscoe loved the album. We fell out a few years later, after the master tape was stolen and Terry had flipped. It was during the New Wave era. His station had pretty much forsaken Terry Jester. I went to Roscoe and pleaded with him to get some of Terry's stuff back on the air. I asked for old time's sake. I mean, Roscoe had built some of his rep on Terry's back. I figured the least he could do was return the favor.
He turned you down?
Better than that. He had me thrown out of the station by security, the drunk bastard.
Jesse asked, You tried to bribe him, didn't you?
Not exactly.
Exactly how was it?
He was having marital troubles at the time, and maybe I had some unflattering photos of him with a woman about Bella's age.
Blackmail? No wonder he had you thrown out. You sent his wife the photos? White waved his hands in disgust.
I'm not proud of what I did. But he owed Terry, and he owed me, and he pissed on us when we needed a little help.
That's not the issue now, Jesse said. If I can get him to do it, will the record company accept his word?
Mr. Honesty, with his rep? Sure.
Jesse grabbed his cell phone. Chapter 81. Roscoe Niles didn't make it easy on Jesse, but caved in the end.
For you, Jesse, and for Jen and Diana. But make it clear to that prick I'm not doing it for him.
I'm pretty sure he gets that, Roscoe. The ad appeared in the paper the next day. But this time, when the hangman called, he rang Stan White's cell phone, not the landline at the Wickham estate. Stan put it on speakerphone so they could all listen to the conversation.
I have the money, White said, but there's a problem.
Bullshit. The distorted voice crackled over the cell's speaker. You're stalling. The tape's going to burn.
No, no, listen. It's not a stall. Don't burn it.
White pleaded his case, explaining about the record label's condition for payment. There was a tense moment of hesitation.
Only Niles hears it. I sense the tape is being recorded, or if the call is being traced, the tape burns. Give me his cell number.
Jesse gave White the number, and White repeated it into the phone.
2 hours from now, Niles gets into his car and drives straight to the Wrentham Village outlets and parks in a spot as far away from the stores and other cars as possible. I'll know if he's being followed or watched. Remember, any tricks and the tape burns. I want the money, but money won't do me any good in prison. I'll call tonight.
At 7 p.m., Roscoe Niles showed up at the Wickham estate. Jesse introduced Roscoe to Bella Lawton. Bella seemed unimpressed by her new acquaintance. Jesse had no trouble understanding, because his friend was dressed in ragged jeans, red Chuck Taylors, and a Moody Blues t-shirt that featured the cover of In Search of the Lost Chord. The shirt was as stretched and faded as everything else in Roscoe's wardrobe.
Nice outfit, Stan White said at the sight of his old nemesis. Screw you, Stan. Should I have worn a tux?
White asked.
What happened? Did he call? Did...
Niles ignored the question, turning to Jesse.
I need a drink, man. Authentication is thirsty work.
Bella Lawton volunteered.
I'll get it.
What the hell happened? White asked, his face turning bright red. Relax, you old prick. As soon as I get my drink, I'll tell you.
Bella Lawton came back into the room, a rocks glass half full of scotch in her right hand. Conversation stopped the moment she re-entered. She was dressed in a tight white dress and cream-colored heels. She really seemed to be turning it on, much like she had the morning she showed up at Jesse's door. But it was difficult to discern whether Roscoe Niles' eyes were bulging out at the sight of the scotch or at the woman delivering it. Both, Jesse decided. Niles gulped down the scotch.
Well, what happened? White asked again.
Niles smiled and shook the empty glass at Bella. She took the glass and said, I'll be right back, Mr. Niles.
What happened? You want to know what happened, man? I'll tell you what happened. 30 years ago, you ruined my marriage, you son of a bitch.
White wasn't having it.
I wasn't the one screwing some 22-year-old chippy. That was you, you fat drunk. I did your wife a favor, freeing her from the likes of you.
Niles charged White, landing a glancing punch to White's jaw before Jesse could tackle him. Jesse was surprised at how powerful the old DJ was, but emotion and adrenaline counted for a lot.
Calm down, Roscoe, Jesse said, putting his friend in an arm lock. Are you all right, Stan?
Fine, White said, rubbing his jaw. Fine! But the faster this schmuck tells me what happened, the sooner he can get out of here and we can get on with things.
You gonna behave if I let you up, Roscoe?
Yeah, man, I'm sorry. I've just been waiting 30 years to do that.
Well, you did it. Now tell the man what he needs to know.
Jesse released Niles. The DJ got up in pieces, shaking the pain out of his arm as he stood. Bella tried to deliver his second drink, but Jesse grabbed the glass.
Talk first, drink later.
It's a real thing, Niles said. And I'll be damned. It's fucking brilliant. He played me the whole tape, first song to last. Man, no wonder Terry Jester never re-recorded it. He would never have been able to recapture what's on that tape.
Jesse handed the scotch to Niles, who polished the drink off in a single gulp, some of the amber fluid dribbling down his chin.
Will you tell that to the record execs? White asked. I promised Jesse I would, so yeah, I will. Have him call me.
Before Niles could finish his sentence, White was punching a number into his cell phone and handing the phone to Niles. When the DJ was done swearing the tape was the real deal, he said his goodbyes and headed back to Boston. Chapter 82. It wasn't lost on Jesse that the last time he had done something like this, Suit wound up getting shot. Nor had he forgotten that the end result of what he'd done that fateful day eventually resulted in Diana's murder. But as he drove along a stretch of two-lane highway north and west of Paradise, the sun getting low in the sky, Jesse tried hard to push those thoughts out of his head and to keep all other demons at bay. He couldn't afford a lack of focus, not if he wanted a chance to recover the tape and to get Kernet's killer. It had all seemed to happen so quickly after Roscoe Niles had authenticated the tape. After that, the other hurdles were more easily cleared. In spite of the DA's objections, he gave his go-ahead to handle things Jesse's way. It helped that Lundquist had given his support and that Mayor Walker had kept her word, backing Jesse as well. There was little chance she wouldn't. There was no downside for her. If he succeeded in capturing Kernet's killer and recovering the tape, she would take partial credit for his success. If he failed, she had distanced herself enough that the fallout would all blow in Jesse's direction. Of course, what he hadn't shared with the mayor or anybody else involved was that he had hedged his bet. He was sticking his neck out a long way, just not quite as far as everyone assumed he was. After the meeting at the DA's office, Nita Thompson pulled Jesse aside. "I hope you know what you're doing. This could blow up in your face. The day I start worrying more about covering my ass than doing the right thing, I'll quit." "If you fail, Jesse, you won't have to quit. The mayor will do that for you." "Uh-huh." An entire day had passed since then. The record label had wired the money to a Boston bank, and an armored car had carried it up to Paradise. It had taken a while to assemble $6 million in varied denominations of used, non-consecutive bills. Funny thing was that none of them, not Jesse or White or Lundquist, had anticipated just how big a pile $6 million made. "Good thing you've got an SUV, Jesse," Lundquist said. "That's not going to fit in anyone's carry-on bag." Jesse had laughed at that, but wondered if the blackmailer had bothered to calculate how he'd manage all that money. If not, Jesse thought, it might give him the opportunity he needed to grab the hangman. Lundquist and the DA had argued for Jesse to chemically mark the bills in spite of the hangman's warnings and demands, but Jesse had rejected the idea. "We're going to play this as much his way as we can. We're not going to mark the bills. We're not going to put a tracking device with the money. No one is going to follow me in a car." These days, everyone walked around with a tracking device on his or her person. The hangman would know that, and it was pretty much a given that Jesse would have to toss his cell phone somewhere along the route. The hangman's instructions had been simple. After emphasizing that he would burn the tape if any of his instructions weren't followed, or if he sensed a trap was being set, he told Jesse to leave Paradise and travel back roads in a northwesterly direction toward the confluence of the Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont borders. Just south of Lowell, he got the call he'd been expecting. The hangman directed him to a roadside gas station.
"Go into the men's room," the distorted voice said. "Drop your cell phone in the toilet. You'll find a new phone in a plastic bag in the toilet tank. And, Chief, if you have any tracking devices on you, plant it in the money or your vehicle. This would be your chance to ditch them."
"There aren't any."
"Okay. Then head back the way you came, and keep the new phone close. I'll be calling you shortly."
The bathroom was like almost every other gas station bathroom he'd been in. It stank of human waste and pine disinfectant. The mirror was cracked and duct-taped to the wall. He was glad he had brought gloves with him when he lifted up the top of the toilet and fished out the bagged phone floating inside. As Jesse left the bathroom, new phone in hand, he He noticed the surveillance camera mounted on the edge of the building. It was aimed at the pumps, so he doubted it would have captured images of the person who had planted the phone in the toilet tank. But even as he got in his car and headed back toward Paradise, there was something about the camera that stuck in Jesse's head. It nagged at him until the ringing phone diverted his attention.
"Sorry to do this to you, Chief, but you're going to have to about-face and follow my directions. Do you understand?"
"I do."
"Good. When you get to where you're going, call the number taped to the back of the phone."
Jesse did as he was instructed, making a U-turn as soon as passing traffic allowed. And as he passed the gas station he'd pulled out of only a few minutes before, that nagging feeling about the surveillance camera came back to him.